advisement. Next is Lisa Balducci versus Brian Siggy, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. If counsel could please step forward. May we please have appearances of counsel?
Brian Siggy, representing Appellant.
Edward Zahn, arguing for the New Jersey State Bar Association.
Richard Shaw, on behalf of the National Employment Employers Association of New Jersey. Stephanie Corporal, on behalf of the New Jersey Association of Justice.
And Jay Rice, Naval Rice, on behalf of the plaintiff respondent, Lisa Balducci.
Welcome, counsel. Good afternoon. Mr. Siggy, please go ahead.
Chief Justice, Associate Justices, Counsel. In my preliminary statement, I'd like to take the opportunity to ask you to focus on two themes. The first being, why the rush? And the second being, retroactivity. Thank you for granting the petition for certification. I appreciate the State Bar Association filing papers in support of your doing so. That being said, I understand that there are implications to the appellate division decision that go beyond what was decided by the trial judge. Amicus, focusing on the appellate division decision, I want to direct my comments to errors at the trial court level, which I think are significant and foundational to what happened at the appellate division. I refer to the trial court as the AJTJ, the assignment judge trial judge, and the reason I do that is because she was wearing two hats at the time she was making her rulings. I was involved in a conference, as the record reflects, to try to resolve the underlying claim. That conference did not result in a settlement because I had requested additional information on the status of the case before agreeing to compromise my fee as requested by the AJTJ. Immediately subsequent, counsel was retained to file litigation challenging my retainer agreement. An expedited plenary hearing was scheduled. I think if your honors look at the transcript of the order to show cause that resulted in the scheduling, you'll see I questioned why discovery was not being afforded. There was no urgency. There could have been a delay in the plenary hearing, but I was really being fast-tracked and double-teamed, I respectfully submit, at that point. I questioned at the end of the order to show cause what the subject of the plenary hearing was going to be. At the plenary hearing, I testified, and I rely on my testimony at the plenary hearing as setting forth the relationship. I submit to the court, although there's no way to challenge it now, that false testimony was given by Ms. Balducci regarding conversations between the two of us. Between her and I, and the trial judge accepted her testimony, and there's nothing I can do about that now. But what I can submit, as I put in my papers to the appellate division, that there was an expediency to get to a result which required that my retainer agreement be voided in order to set aside my sufficiently pled lien, attorney's lien, so that the underlying case could be resolved. The mindset is all over the record. You will see at the end of the plenary hearing that the AJTJ indicated, quote, let's get this matter resolved so the underlying case can resolve itself. Subsequently, in a letter opinion, the AJTJ said, this court will be in touch with parties to establish a hearing and briefing schedule to determine quantum merit of Mr. Siggy's work. I submit to the court And again, I asked in my petition for certification that the court take judicial notice of what it could, but that the Vicinage 13 backlog in 2016 placed it at 15 out of 21 counties. After this decision against my retainer agreement in 2017, the jump was to 9th out of 21 counties.
Mr. Sigge, I'm very sorry to interrupt your opening statement, but we're here reviewing a judgment of the appellate division.
Understood.
And you need to tell us what's wrong with that, respectfully, and why you should prevail. Let's focus your remarks in that
perspective. I will do that, Your Honor. Let me jump then to the retroactivity argument. There is no indication prior to the appellate division decision that the form of my retainer agreement was in any way an error. It was plain language. It had provisions in it that said that that Ms. Balducci understood what she was reading. We understand her to be a paralegal. She had litigation experience, even with me. There was no addressing at the appellate division the parole evidence rule, which, again, was raised by me at the time of the plenary hearing. I worked for more than 3 years on the case. And when she decided that she didn't want to follow the terms of the retainer agreement, I cooperated in the transition of the file. As I indicated to the appellate division, prior to its issuing its decision, the case was marked resolved before the paperwork for the settlement had been filed. And that was not addressed by the appellate division. At no time did the appellate division acknowledge that none of my itemized bills were challenged. There were some questions raised about the expenses that weren't itemized in my retainer agreement, but there was no addressing the fact that those same expenses were not itemized in the retainer agreement by successor counsel, which I believe is DA 50 to 53. So there's no indication in that about itemization of specific costs of copying or photocopying or faxing. Apologize. So the appellate division accepted the credibility determinations of the trial court. And I just want to emphasize that I believe that there was bias in the finding of the credibility determinations of the trial court for the reasons that I started with saying. And so in the appellate division brief, which has been provided to the Supreme Court, I questioned the AJ, TJ's decision-making, the rush, how we got to it, and that was not addressed by the appellate division. And I believe that was an error of the appellate division. It's just not in there at all. No addressing of the parole evidence rule, no saying why the retainer agreement should not be bound. Now, there are suggestions in the appellate division decision that I should have advised the client of looking for other counsel. That doesn't exist anymore. When this case blew up from a three-party case to a 16-party case, which was the decision of the AJ TJ, I never went back to the client and said, this is more complicated, we need to change our retainer agreement. I stuck with the retainer agreement as it was. I didn't stop the client from saying to me, we need to change the agreement for whatever reason. The expenses are getting too high. I stuck with the agreement, and there was never any complaints about the agreement by the client until she decided she wanted to change counsel. And so I have a lien, which isn't really addressed by the appellate division. They then want to get to quantum merit, which makes my lien go away. The appellate division doesn't note my objections to the lien going away. And it leaves us in a situation where where a client could, who has an hourly agreement, could just say, no, I don't want to pay it, and I'm going to go find an attorney who's going to do it on a contingency, and you're out of luck. So I just don't, I think it's fundamentally unfair.
Putting aside the questions that the amicus, amici, are raising. The appellate division, with respect to your case, said for the reasons expressed in its opinion, referring to the trial judge's opinion, the court entered an order declaring the retainer agreement unenforceable and void. And then when you look at the trial court's opinion, it rendered credibility findings.
Right.
It wound up finding Ms. Balducci and her son credible and you not credible. And the appellate division found that that was sustained by sufficient credible evidence on the record. How do you get over that?
Okay, the way I get over, look, I take full responsibility for not requesting oral argument before the appellate division. I do note, and I don't know that it would have made a difference, that the appellate division had previously set aside a retainer agreement in an N.J. Ladd case based on a judge's, I think it's the A.W. case.
Are you asking us to ignore the evidence of the hearing?
I'm sorry, Judge?
Are you asking us to ignore the evidence of the hearing?
No, I'm asking you to acknowledge yes. that in the unique case where issues are raised as to the credibility findings, because the AJTJ was trying to expedite the matter and the goal was to set aside my retainer agreement.
How are we going to – we don't have that – you're questioning the motives of the judge. The judge made specific fact findings. The judge found – that you did not explain portions of your retainer agreement. She found Ms. Balducci credible, and she found your exploitation not credible. And if we just look at the record, and we're not credibility finders here, there seems to be at least enough in the record to support that. So I'm trying to figure out how do you surmount that.
I understand I'm in a very difficult spot. I've been in a difficult spot since that finding. But I don't think this court should ignore the possible conflict that I'm raising. That's on one hand.
Under what standard of review should we not do what you suggest? We have findings of fact from the trial court. We've reviewed those. We don't make independent findings of fact. The witnesses aren't here. So under what standard of review could we possibly accede to what you seek?
Well, I think you can look at the totality of what was argued in the appellate division brief, which was submitted to this court. And if there is an appearance
Wasn't the totality of the appellate brief that the findings of the court below were inconsistent, were inappropriate, and they disagreed and affirmed? So,
yeah, I completely
do it ask us that disregard the appellate division, find some hitting meaning in what the judge was doing, which is not present, disregard all those findings of fact and rule in your favor. Under what standard of review, appellate review, could our court possibly do that? What case suggests that we can do that?
Look, there's not a case on an appearance of impropriety of this type of situation. I understand that. But where is the dealing with the parole evidence rule?
Before the parole evidence rule, what's the appearance of impropriety? A judge took testimony.
Understood.
From individuals. That testimony is inconsistent. One of the proponents offered testimony that's false. The judge made a finding based on the evidence that was presented in court. Why is there a potential conflict in that? I don't understand.
Okay. Again, we don't have a statement from the judge. I'm not trying to put the judge on trial. But what I'm suggesting is that there was a rush to reach the conclusion of voiding my retainer agreement, and I've raised issues with why that rush existed. I've raised it from the beginning. And I believe that there was a determination to void my retainer agreement to resolve the underlying case, and the dominoes fall.
Based on the pace with which the judge scheduled this matter?
Based on not allowing discovery, based on the quick scheduling of the hearing after the order to show cause, not explaining what was going to be the subject of the hearing in any detail, which I had requested, finding what was necessary to void the retainer agreement, and then in the record, all kinds of language about, now that we got that out of the way, let's get this case resolved.
But you got a hearing. I mean, you got to testify. You had the opportunity of cross-examining Ms. Balducci and her son. So you got that. With respect to the parole evidence, is there a case that suggests that parole evidence would apply in a retainer agreement? I'm finding it difficult, given our language in many, many cases. But I'm looking at Cohen versus Radio Electronics. An attorney's freedom of the contract with a client is subject to the constraints of ethical considerations and our supervision. That's the court's supervision. Consequently, courts scrutinize contracts between attorneys and clients to ensure that they are fair. And to me, that means if an attorney says to a client something that is directly contradictory to what is written, that might void the agreement, and the parole evidence rule would never come into play. So I'm going to give you an opportunity to respond to that.
Your Honor, all I can say is that the reason for the parole evidence rule is so after things go wrong when there's a written contract and parties say that something was said that may or may not have been said.
That may be true among sophisticated commercial people, but when we're dealing with a consumer, dealing with an attorney, and given the ethical considerations underlying retainer agreements, I don't see how the parole evidence rule would ever come into play. Are you suggesting that parole evidence would bar testimony coming in that an attorney said, you know, that part of the retainer agreement, that's not going to apply to you? Do you think that would happen?
No, that wouldn't happen, Your Honor. That wouldn't happen. But, you know, I'm putting in front of you a series of events. And I said to you that the record does not evidence it, but that I was confronted with false testimony at the plenary hearing. The judge bought the false testimony. I understand that. The question is why? And is there enough of a question in the why so that we are not bound by that finding? So because if we're not bound by the trial level finding, then the appellate division cannot rely on it to make its determination.
So that's really
the argument.
You're being rather diplomatic, and I appreciate that. But what I'm hearing you suggest is not an appearance of a conflict, but that the judge bought false testimony because the judge was biased or predisposed to reach that conclusion. And I must tell you, having reviewed the record, I don't see it. And all I hear is speculation coming from you right now.
And I understand your interpretation. I appreciate your understanding my being diplomatic, but I believe that I was steamrolled in this matter. And the goal was to void my retainer agreement.
I'm trying to figure out what would be wrong with the judge wanting to resolve this issue, knowing that this issue was going to be central to resolving the case.
There's nothing,
because there were settlement discussions, and the nature of the fees owed were going to be central to that consideration. Like, why wouldn't the judge want to resolve this issue first?
I agree a judge would, and I could have been brought into the settlement negotiations. I could have been a participant in the mediation process. I could have been involved in a settlement, but what I was being asked by the AJTJ was to compromise my legal fees without knowing what the result was going to be. And it's when I declined because I did not know what the result was going to be. Again, my last information was that my client directed me to communicate a $3.5 million settlement demand. I did what she asked. I was never asked to resolve the case for anything less. I thought it was a $1 million case. It was based on that the attorney's fees, which blew up because the AJTJ allowed it to become a 16-party case, and again, I never went back and said my retainer agreement should be any different. We were moving ahead. I never got any other instructions from my client. The reason this blew up is because she didn't want to pay the expenses that she was obligated to under the same retainer agreement, and then found a personal injury attorney.
Well, claiming she was required to pay your hourly rate, whether she was successful or not. So did you ever advise your client that, you know, this bill could exceed $200,000, maybe even $300,000, and you're going to be on the hook for that.
Your Honor, I had no doubt that she read and understood the retainer agreement. I was sending her monthly bills.
But did
I
you
would
ever
not have
tell
done
her
it if
that?
It was contingency only.
So one of the things, you, as an attorney, you know you have to consider is your client's ability to pay the bill. So,
absolutely.
So you have to know whether what the client's income is, what the client's assets are, and then also the risks being undertaken. Don't you think that if you're going to charge on an hourly basis and hold the client to the hourly basis, you would have some obligation to advise what the ultimate cost may be if the client is unsuccessful?
Your Honor, I had no doubt that this case was going to resolve favorably. If you'll recall, this was the unique situation where we filed against two boards of education, because in Hunterdon County they have different boards for, you know, like the lower schools and the high school. And this bullying took place, you know, through several grades, including into high school. And this case was so strong that the two boards third-partied in the individual bullies and their parents as defendants. So I basically had the Board of Education's, who were defendants in this case, supporting my claim as to how bad the behavior was of these students.
That's not the only reason why you third-party people in. You can claim that there was nothing wrong, that they did it all. It's not because of the conduct, or if anything is wrong, it was them, not you. You don't third-party people in because you think the claim is wrong. You third-party people in because it's good practice to bring in potential culpable parties.
Immediate motion practice to get the individuals out of this case, which was denied by the AJTJ.
Here again, that's really not all that much of a surprise either. I mean, you're talking about pleading third-party practice before all the discovery's in. I mean, With all due respect, there's really nothing all that remarkable.
Well, all I can say is, and I'm recalling, you know, the coverage at the time, it was reported as a first impression that bullies were third-partied in on their parents. And there was a lot of coverage, and this was a high-profile case. So I understand it's not an extraordinary practice, but it had been done in this case, which was proof of the substantial nature of the claim.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
There was a declaratory judgment motion filed, and you sort of counterclaimed for all of your fees.
Right.
Were you expecting all of your fees, the $288,000, to be paid before the resolution of the case?
If
you had won on that?
No. I mean, if you look in the record, it started with her moving counsel. I delivered the 18 banker boxes of documents immediately to the other attorney. I sat down and discussed with him the status of the case. And I said to him, I'm owed, I don't remember the exact number, I'll say $15,000 in out-of-pocket. And my experience is that when cases change hands, that the expenses are, you know, recouped, and then what happens with the legal fees happens at the end of the case. And that's where I was. And I reached out to him and I said, are you going to be paying me the $15,000? And he said, I'm not involved in that. That's between you and Ms. Balducci. So I wrote to her and I said, look, am I going to get the $15,000 from you? If I need to pursue this under the entire controversy doctrine, I've got to put in a claim for everything, not just the fees. So I sent her the standard letter. It's in the record of your rights for fee arbitration, and then this is the expenses and this is the fees. And then in response to my letter, we then had the conference with the judge, the case didn't settle, and then the attorneys hired, and he filed for fee arbitration. And I opposed it. You know, his arbitration was to resolve the claim. I responded, and then arbitration bounced it because they have a $100,000 discretionary cap. And then I did not pursue it further until the litigation, when I had to respond. And so I'm countersuing for my fees because they're litigating saying my retainer agreement's no good. I'm thinking of the entire controversy doctrine and I'm putting the whole amount at issue. I mean, look, I have no problem if there's a determination that I'm not entitled to all those fees, even though not 1 hour of my time was ever challenged over 3 years. I have no problem if this court wants to come up with rules for this hybrid type of retainer agreement or decide that there shouldn't be a, whatever the rules, you know, but I was on the fee arbitration committee. The expenses I charged were standard. Maybe they've changed. Maybe I was in a little bit of a time bubble. But, you know, I've seen all these expenses. My fees expenses have been consistent for a decade or more.
Counsel, since we're a little bit beyond the time
sure,
that you've been
I apologize.
For, tell us what relief you're seeking at this point,
well,
and please sum up your argument.
I appreciate that. I'd like this court to affirm the validity of my retainer agreement. I'd like it to reverse and set aside the findings of the AJTJ. I'd like the credibility findings of the trial judge set aside. I think that then sets aside the reliance of the appellate division on the credibility findings of the court. I'd like this court to confirm that the retainer agreement was, and as we stand here today, still is a binding retainer agreement. If your honors decide that you want to change the requirements at any time in the future, I have no objection. I just think it's wrong that my conduct should be determined unethical based on a change that occurs. I submit that I did not act unethically at any time in any of my dealings with Ms. Balducci, and I'd like the court to review the papers submitted, hear the arguments of counsel, and confirm that. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Zahn.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chief Justice, Associate Justices, Counsel, may it please the Court. My name is Edward Zahn. I'm arguing for the New Jersey State Bar Association. I am the chair of the State Bar Association's Solo and Small Firm Committee and I have been practicing law in law firms of two or fewer attorneys for 20 years. In this matter, the appellate division went much further than it needed to do to decide the facts of the case and review the trial court's decision. The New Jersey State Bar Association is very concerned about the impact of the appellate division's ruling on small firms and solo firms who are, in many cases, the front line for clients who are trying to prosecute fee-shifting matters. Most law firms in the state of New Jersey are solo and small firms, or an overwhelming majority of these firms, somewhere above 90%, are firms that are defined as small firms, that is, five or fewer attorneys. Over half of the attorneys who are in private practice, approximately 54%, are in firms with five or fewer attorneys. So this is not theoretical, these are practical problems.
The appellate division, are you arguing against the rules that the appellate division promulgated, or is your argument beyond that?
No, it's only limited to that. It's only limited to the rules that the appellate division promulgated and the effect of those rules.
Thank you.
In fact, although you didn't ask the question, Your Honor, the State Bar Association has no opinion on the retainer agreement itself.
Thank you.
So there were two major problems with the appellate division's ruling. First, that the appellate division partook in improper rulemaking, and second, even if you allow that the rulemaking was proper, the rules that are promulgated are unworkable.
In what way? What'd you get to the bottom line? In what way are they unworkable? How are they improper?
They're unworkable because it would impose requirements on attorneys to refer cases to competition or take fee-shifting matters strictly on contingency and front expenses. And neither of those things are possible in the current environment. Right. Regarding the improper rulemaking, the appellate division expanded disclosure requirements for fee-shifting cases. The New Jersey Supreme Court, who I'm before right now, has the exclusive rulemaking authority. The appellate division effectively imposed seven specific requirements and went well beyond Rules of Professional Conduct 1.4 and 1.5, effectively creating new rules.
Could we ask you to focus your argument on the second point?
Sure, absolutely, absolutely. The workability, the appellate division's rules have a significant negative impact on especially solo and small firms attorneys to serve clients.
They are precedential and published. The appellate division published.
Why don't you tick off the rules one by one that you think are off base, and tell us what you think the appellate division said and why you think it was wrong.
Okay, I will go to the. Hold on one moment.
You've done that in your brief already.
I identified seven specific items.
And the first one was if an attorney's fees fee in an LAD or statutory fee shifting case is based in whole or in part on hourly, the attorney is ethically obligated to advise the client of the ramifications of that.
Right.
Am I stating that correctly?
Yes, that is what the brief says. And the problem with that is that fee shifting and this is a problem for a lot of the seven rules, fee shifting is a different issue. It's a different concept than contingency cases. It's the fee shifting is not intended, as far as I know, to substitute for contingency. Fee shifting is intended to reimburse the plaintiff in the matter if he or she should win the case.
Well, in fairness to the appellate division, they were dealing with a hybrid retainer agreement, which
right.
had both elements in it.
That's right.
But if you're taking it away, I know you're not opining on that particular retainer
right.
agreement. What is wrong with if there is an unusual situation where you have a fee shifting case, but you're going to include it for an hourly rate in the retainer,
mm-hmm.
that you tell the client the ramifications of that?
There's nothing wrong with telling the client the ramifications of that. The problem in the appellate division's decision that imposes additional requirements for the attorney to recommend to the client that other attorneys may take these cases on pure
that's
contingency.
That's one of your later. That's
right.
one of your,
that's number
right.
seven.
That's
right.
That's your number seven. So
okay.
so
number one for a little
okay.
bit.
So that's number one.
There is nothing wrong with requiring the attorney to explain the ramifications of his or her retainer agreement to the
okay.
to the.
In fact, the lawyer should do that.
Exactly.
So then, why do you have a problem with number one then? If there's nothing wrong with it.
Well.
That rulemaking.
The rulemaking
rule
part
yeah.
of it. The rulemaking part
okay.
of it. I'm not saying that the...
Well, that's in our rules already.
Right. It's in the... So
that's common sense, that an attorney should advise the client of the ramifications of the retainer agreement. So, for instance, if the attorney is going to insist
mm-hmm.
on an hourly rate that the client is responsible,
mm-hmm.
win or lose, then the attorney has an obligation of... saying what this may cost at the end of the day.
Right.
Do you agree?
Yes.
Okay.
I do.
So then you get the next one, which is the attorney has to inform the client that if the case becomes complicated and goes on, the hourly rate obligation may approach or exceed the worth of the case.
This is another one of those situations, to cut to the chase, to use the vernacular, this is another one of those situations which might not be bad in and of
aren't
itself.
Aren't you already required to explain to the client? So it's not really a new rule. That's part of the rule.
It's part of the ethical requirements, I agree.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, okay. I guess number three is where it gets interesting.
Yes. They get worse as they go along.
Okay. Tell us what's wrong.
The attorney must inform the client other competent counsel represents clients in similar cases solely on a contingent fee basis without an hourly component and might also advance costs. This is impossible. The reason it's impossible is that attorneys cannot be, and should not, consult with other of their colleagues about how they charge for fee-shifting cases, how they charge for contingency cases. The attorney cannot recommend to the client that other attorneys may take these cases because we don't know.
Generally,
do we really not know that?
We really don't know that.
So, are you familiar with Rule 1:21-7?
Yes.
And in B, it presents sort of the mirror image. That an attorney shall not enter into a contingent fee arrangement without first having advised the client of the right to retain an attorney under a fee for services, under an hourly rate
right.
scheme. Is the rule completely off? We shouldn't be thinking about
no.
this possibility?
The appellate division went much further than restating that portion of Rule 1.
Isn't your concern with this rule that you're asking an attorney to determine if someone else is competent, could be subject to ethical violations, malpractice if that attorney doesn't do a good job because it was recommended by the attorney. And same with number four, providing examples of similar cases. How would anyone know with that extensive research what cases are similar or not? Isn't that really a concern with the rule?
Yes, it is. Right. That we can't.
And the same with number seven.
The same with number seven, correct. That we can't represent to our potential clients that a specific attorney will do it for this fee or that fee, will advance fee, advance costs or not advance costs, because we don't know. In general, Mr. Chief Justice, that is true, that we can recommend to clients that there are other possibilities, but the Appellate Division went further in stating that you have to almost recommend that your client go to competitors or have specific knowledge of what your competitors in your area would charge this same client to do this kind of case.
You agree that the attorney should be advising the client if the attorney is going to insist on the client advancing the costs, what those costs are likely to be.
Yes. As a purely ethical, yes, it is. It would be a very good thing and consistent with the ethics rules to say, in your case, costs are likely to be $2,000 or $10,000.
You also have a duty to tell your client that you've never handled this kind of case before, you're not an expert. However, the requirement of finding someone who you believe is competent in referring, that's what you object to, not the fact. You should tell the client if you don't know, if you've never tried a case like that before.
Absolutely.
Practice,
I would never.
Construction, you should advise them that you have no experience or what experience
right.
you have.
I mean, I only have experience personally in two specific types of fee shifting cases. The only ones I would take, and I wouldn't do the others.
I understand, but you can't. I don't think you can tell me if I'm mistaken about this. They're all different types of LAD cases. Okay, you can have a sex discrimination case,
right.
a racial, a religious, a bullying case. Merely because you've handled one form, you may have handled many of one form, or handling for the first time another, there's no different way of handling the case. Now, I don't know whether there's an obligation of saying, you know, I've handled 50 of these, but never one of these. Do you think you have to do that?
Well, that wasn't the State Bar's concern. The State Bar's concern is the requirement to specifically refer the potential client to other counsel.
I'm not sure that's what the Appellate Division said, looking at the precise language that they used. I understand how one might fear that, but they're not directing that you refer someone to specific other counsel.
We don't know, as Soles and small firm attorneys, we don't know if other similarly situated attorneys would take a case like this on pure contingency. I don't know that.
Let me ask this. You're here as a friend of the court,
okay.
And we appreciate
right.
your experience and insight. Are there deficiencies in the rules as they currently exist that need to be addressed that a case like this has highlighted?
I don't think so. But if there were, the proper way to do it is to refer it to the Civil Practice Committee, this court's Civil Practice Committee, and not impose what seemingly look like new requirements, because this case has effectively put on additional requirements well beyond RPC 1.4, 1.6, Rule 1.20:21, far beyond that. We would effectively have to tell the clients that they may not want to stay in our office. They might want to go
and
somewhere
else. And number four is that the attorney should provide examples of how much hourly fees have totaled in similar cases. How can that possibly be done?
It can't be done, Your Honor. That's the answer, Justice Patterson.
Because every one of these cases is different. Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
I didn't understand about the Appellate Division, which I think may be a common practice. Most of these cases settle, correct?
Okay,
in a case that didn't settle, it has a fee-shifting statute, and it has a contingency fee basis.
Mm-hmm.
And it's if the agreement is the greater of the fee shifting or the greater of the contingency with the fee shift on top of it, then divided by like one third. Like if you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. But
in the situation where the attorney wants to rely on the contingency fee, and you're getting a fee shifting fee, does that go on top of the overall recovery when dividing it up? Are you following me?
Yeah, I am. I wouldn't think so, but again, I personally, I don't do LAD cases, but I've done consumer fraud and landlord-tenant cases for the recovery of security deposits, both of which have fee shifting components. And on these cases,
So you would interpret, we'll hear from your colleagues.
Sure.
When one of these retainer agreements says it's the greater of the fee shifting or the contingency, you just look at the fee shifting amount and you just look at the recovery and whatever is greater.
That's what I would do, yes. That would be
the greater. Let me see if I understand that. You would add the recovery to the client plus the fees and divide by three?
No, I think the recovery is, I think, Justice Albin, I think this is what you're saying, that the recovery is separate from the additional fee shifting for fees. It's a separate item.
Right.
Right.
So how would you calculate the fee in that case, in this kind
if
of
a contingent fee, I believe, would be based strictly on the damages, not the fee
right.
shifting.
Okay. So the fee shifting would be in addition to the one-third.
Is there any, would there be any violation of the RPCs if a retainer agreement said it's the greater of the fees or the recovery plus on top of that the fees divided, and then I would look at one or the other? Is that a violation of the RPCs?
Well, the RPCs say, I'm trying to think out loud,
because the appellate division seems to suggest you can't do that.
I think,
if I'm reading it correctly.
I think they are suggesting you can't do that.
What is there prohibiting that? I'm trying to figure that out.
Well, the general rule that you can't recover more than the certain percentage of the contingency matter, but...
No, the contingency fee would always remain according to the rule. You can't
right.
change that. The question is, if you got a judgment from a jury,
right.
you got the award, and then the judge determines that you're entitled to fees, when you're figuring out the greater or the one or the two, are you permitted, for the purposes of the contingency fee, putting the fees on top of that when you're doing the calculation?
I don't think you are, and I actually think that I think this would be limited by RPC 1.5.
Is there anything you'd like to add?
We understand the lower court's concerns about attracting competent counsel, but effectively forcing attorneys to prosecute fee-shifting cases solely on contingency, or recommending an attorney who we think may do that doesn't promote that end. It would probably limit the number of attorneys who decide to take these cases.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Shaw.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and thank you for giving me the opportunity on behalf of the New Jersey chapter of the National Employment Lawyers Association to come here and try to shed some light on some of these issues. Our organization is made up of about 150 lawyers, all of whom practice plaintiff's employment law, all of whom regularly handle cases under the LAD and under SEPA. And so the issues that the new rules that have been created by the appellate division, which we think are ill-advised, would directly affect our practice. Justice Timpone had asked a question of prior counsel as to our opinion as to the outcome of this case. We don't object to what the appellate division did here in finding the retainer agreement unenforceable and in finding that all that plaintiff's attorney is entitled to here is the quantum merit, just so to be clear on that. Our issue is with the rules that the appellate division created, because we think there are two principal problems with those rules. One of the principal problems arises from the perspective of the appellate division that kind of permeated their decision that hourly rates somehow undermine the goals of the LAD in fully compensating clients and undermine the goal of the LAD in attracting competent counsel. And we think that assumption or that conclusion or that finding that was made by the appellate division, and again I would point out that that finding was made without any research, without any study, without being referred to a committee, is wrong. That's one of the points I'd like to make. The other point I'd like to address is that I think, in fact, these rules that have been created by the appellate division, if allowed to stand, rather than furthering the goals that the appellate division purportedly had in advancing these rules, I think they would have a perverse effect in forcing clients, forcing plaintiffs in LAD cases to less competent, less qualified attorneys, and that would be a very bad result. So we would encourage the court to reverse only that portion of the appellate division decision creating these rules. It was an ad hoc undertaking on their part. We would strongly suggest that if there are going to be new rules that are created, this is not the way to do it under the facts of one particular case. And if there are going to be any new rules created, it really should be done the study with input from various bar associations thoughtfully and not in an ad hoc decision that may have been motivated in part by some distaste for some of the particular provisions in the retainer agreement here.
Set aside the process and how a rule might actually look. We have a rule right now, and I'm paraphrasing 127, that says don't enter into a contingency fee arrangement without having a conversation about hourly rates. Do we need a variant of that that flips the principle?
Well, I'm very glad you raised that point, Your Honor, and I did not raise it in my brief, but I think one of the interesting things about the appellate division decision here is that it does flip that rule on its head. It's basically saying that attorneys have to suggest contingency fee arrangements to clients and, you know, should shy away from or not even are permitted to offer hourly rates. My understanding of Rule 121:7.B, and I've been practicing employment law for 30 years, in my firm, we feel we have an obligation before we even suggest to a client a contingency arrangement that we first offer an hourly arrangement. That's how I read 120. That's how I read that rule that you referred to.
That's a rule that applies to every personal injury case. No one can take a personal injury case unless they explain the alternative of billing on an hourly rate or a contingency fee rate. Am I correct about that?
You're correct, and I think it applies to employment cases as well. And we've followed that practice, you know, for 30 years.
Because a client, the easy case is a personal injury case when you're dealing with a passenger in a car who can't possibly be liable, might well be off paying on an hourly basis if the person's going to get $1 million and not having contingency fee.
Justice Alvin, I appreciate that, and very often we may offer the hourly arrangement first, and particularly with clients who can't afford to pay it, they're going to say, I can't afford your rate, Mr. Shaw, I'll do the contingency. But, as I pointed out in my brief, there are clients, particularly well-compensated clients, who come to us and say, you know, let's say they have a, you know, potential $2 or $3 million case, it would make no sense for them to enter into a contingency fee arrangement in all likelihood, because if they have to pay, let's say it's a $3 million case, and they have to pay a third, then they're paying me $1 million in fees. It's an unusual case that my fees, even at my hourly rate, would get to that rate. And so I feel I have a fiduciary obligation to, if the client asks me, how are you going to be better off, honestly, you're better off with an hourly rate.
So that's a very legitimate example. But take the case of an unsophisticated individual that walks into an attorney's office, person without means. Should there be a discussion not simply about hourly rates, but also about contingency fees? Not necessarily referring to specific attorneys or other attorneys, but talking with them about it in the reverse way that 121.7b sets forth.
I'm not sure I understand your question, Your Honor. I mean, I have a firm that my firm will do some work on an hourly basis, some work on a contingent basis. It seems to me that, you know, the appellate division would suggest that, well, because I sometimes offer an hourly rate, I have to refer my cases all.
What the rule requires is that you explain both, explore both the client. There's no preference between one or the other. It's up to the individual client's needs. But you should certainly explore both of them, explain both of them. That's what the present rule
absolutely
seems to
and
require.
That's the rule we follow.
And in those cases where the person can't afford to pay the hourly rate, then the contingency fee is going to be the only basis on which you're going to accept them or they're going to accept you.
Correct. Now sometimes we do a hybrid where we will reduce the hourly rate, you know, if someone, you know, can afford that, and then at the same time reduce the contingent rate. So that's a hybrid arrangement that sometimes exists. But
have you ever seen the type of a retainer agreement we have before us, Mr. Siggy's retainer agreement? Have you looked at it?
I've seen retainer agreements like this, Your Honor, but, and it's a little bit beyond the scope of what I addressed in my brief, but since you asked, my view of the problem here was not so much with a retainer agreement, but was what, I mean, the retainer agreement, according to the appellate division, said at the beginning, all you're going to have to pay me is $7,500. That's what it said, okay, at the beginning of the case. And then if we recover, if there's a settlement at the end of the case, you know, there'll be some kind of contingency arrangement. It seems that somehow what happened, perhaps in discussions here, is that, you know, there was, you know, a change in that, saying that you've got to pay me $288,000 even if you lose, you know, even if you lose the case, and that's what I didn't.
No,
yeah, issue was sort of the...
I thought it's other agreements, you can tell me, in LAD types of cases where it says that there are three methods of recovery for me, lawyer. One is hourly, two is contingent, three is fee shifting, whichever is greatest, that's what I'm getting.
Yes, that's fairly standard.
Win or lose?
No, the win or lose part, that's not standard. That's where the problem is.
Well that's what I'm asking.
Oh,
when because lose is you pay the hourly rate.
If we lose, if the attorney loses under that type of retainer agreement,
right,
the attorney gets nothing.
That's not accurate. If the hourly rate you pay whether you win or lose, contingency based on the contingency, that's what's called that you win the case. Fee shifting also depends on whether you win the case or not. Then the court creates the lodestar, determines up and grades up and down depending on the result. Hourly, you pay regardless. That's the difference between hourly and contingent. That's why it's called a contingency fee agreement. So if you lose on an hourly, you still receive your money. If it's clear in the agreement. But hourly doesn't mean if you lose, you don't get anything. That's why hourly is hourly.
Well,
that's
when we
if you have a different agreement
with
that,
when we have an hourly arrangement with a client, we expect the client, we'll send the client bills on a regular basis. We expect the client to pay those bills on a regular basis. We don't have an hourly arrangement with a client that says we're not going to bill you. You don't have to pay us. And at the end of the case, we're going to send you a bill for $250,000. That's not the way it works. So
exactly. So you just said earlier that if you lost, there would be no hourly fees. There are hourly fees regularly paid, win, lose, or draw.
No. I've never seen an agreement which says that you've got to pay my hourly fees, win, lose, or draw.
You're suggesting that this kind of a three-prong fee agreement is a contingent fee agreement.
Exactly.
The three options are simply how you calculate the fee.
Exactly. But exactly, Justice Solomon.
And that's typical.
It is
typical
contingent.
LAD.
It is entirely contingent. If we lose a case...
And it's typical of LAD.
Yes.
And you're suggesting that the problem in this case is it appears it was not purely contingent. The bill was issued, win, lose, or draw.
Right. So exactly.
If there's
you can't
a problem,
have it both ways. I think that's sort of the problem here. It's either contingent, I'll get paid at the end of the case, or it's hourly. But it's not, it can't be both. And I think that was, I think you've hit the nail on the head.
In your hybrid situation, where you may require money up front, and then you have a fee shifting contingent. If you lose the case, do you return any money?
No, because we billed the client all along. The client has paid us whatever they paid us. If the client at that point were to fire us, God forbid, and hire another attorney, my view is, well, our fee agreement at that point is sort of debt is over. And I think all we would then be, you know, whatever they paid us, we keep it. And after that, it's going to be quantum merit.
But in this kind of case, the retainer at the end of the case, where it's contingent, is applied against the fee you get at the end of the case. The retainer is just so you and the client agree, this is what I need up front to be able to take this case on a contingent fee basis. It'll be applied to the fees at the end, but as I accrue these fees during my handling of the case, they're not refundable.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And I would only recover those fees if I win or if there's a settlement and then we work out.
And you would
out.
Offset the retainer.
But otherwise, I eat it, basically, right. For lack of a better
term. One of the important things in these cases is that the attorney tell the client at the beginning what the expected value of the case is. Because when it settles, and there has to be like compromising of fees, the client's case doesn't get better the longer your case goes on and the more your fees accrue. Want to comment on that?
He might disagree with you that his client's cases don't get better.
Well, I like to think that my clients' cases do get better as they go along, but I think it's certainly very important at the client selection is in my business is one of the key things. And if you have a client who comes in and says my case is worth $5 million, and you look at this case and say no way, this is not a $5 million case, it's time to say, well, you better find another attorney to represent you because differing expectations in our experience. That's the greatest problem that can happen between an attorney and a client. And if you're not on the same page, it's going to create problems down the road.
Anything you'd like to add?
Could I ask one more, sure. Chief, if you don't mind? You've seen the way the State Bar organized these into essentially seven issues that were created by the Appellate Division. You could quibble with how they're divided, but just to use those seven as a... 1, 2, and 3 are about informing clients, the very subject you were just discussing. Do you think that those three represent a departure from the obligations that generally exist under the rules now? And I'm going to go on to the ones that I think are more of a stretch, but I just wanted to... it's on pages 3 and 4 of the...
What page, Your Honor?
Pages 3 and 4 of the State Bar's amicus brief. I just want to ask your advice on these. These are all about, essentially, 1, 2, and 3 are all under the general category of a sort of a heightened need to advise the client about the ramifications of the decision made on how they're going to be billed.
Well, I certainly take issues with 2 and 3,
okay.
Because, as to 2, as I think I pointed out in my brief, it's very difficult to know at the beginning of a case whether it's going to become complex or protracted. With all due respect to the members of the management bar, sometimes we think that a case that should settle quickly, it's straightforward, they don't. And the case goes on for years and years and years, and a case that you would have thought at the beginning should settle quickly, it doesn't. So I think it's very hard to predict that, and so I would take issue with number 2.
Before you go to 3, let's talk about 2. All 2 is saying, and this is the way I understand it, if the client has a $100,000 case and you project you're going to spend $150,000 in fees to get the $100,000 case, you better tell the client that.
Certainly if you're taking...
Attorney must inform the client that if the case becomes complex, the hourly rate-based fee the client is responsible to pay can approach or even exceed his or her recovery. Don't you think that is something that might be told?
These are fee-shifting cases. So even in a case where the fees might get to $150,000, presumably the defendant is going to have to pay some or all of that, in a settlement.
But you've told us that you have hybrid arrangements. They're not all fee-shifting.
Correct.
You pay, to a certain extent, you may be charging the client an hourly rate that the client will be responsible for, win or lose, no?
Yes, and I think if you're charging an hourly rate, then I think you do need to have that conversation with the client.
Well, isn't that what this says? It talks about the hourly rate. They're not asking you to predict the outcome. They're not asking about your fee agreement. They're saying... To explain to the client, if perhaps, you don't know, but if it becomes more complex, the hourly rate may exceed. Isn't that just what they're asking you to do? They're not asking you to predict that the case is going to become complex or not. They're not asking you to predict the outcome.
What they're saying is,
if it becomes more complex, it may exceed it, and you can tell the client that. You don't need to have a mind reader's hat on or anything like that.
I would agree with that, Your Honor, and I think that's something we do. We don't know what's going to happen in these cases, and it can become very expensive.
And shouldn't you tell the client that? That's all they're asking you to do.
Yeah, and you know, I would hope the management side would also tell their clients that if you're going to litigate this thing to the death, your fees could, if it's a $100,000 case, your fees could be $500,000. So I don't know why, if there's anything different in this rule, it's got to apply to both management side and fee-shifting side.
It's a general rule that it says you should really have a detailed discussion with your client about the ramifications of how the case goes.
Right.
But let me just quickly, the 3, 4, and 5 sort of bring in other lawyers.
Yes.
And the comparative and research, we've heard the discussion about that. I assume you have concerns with those.
I do, and I have concerns. I have concerns both with the idea that we should be referring these cases to attorneys who advertise on TV, who say they'll take it on a contingency basis, because in our experience, those attorneys are not necessarily the best qualified attorneys to handle these cases, simply because attorneys like myself and many of the other attorneys I know practice in this area have an hourly rate or may offer hourly arrangements in the appropriate case. I don't think that should put an obligation on us to say, hey, a contingent fee attorney is better.
Okay. And moving on to the thing about research and report about hourly fees have totaled in the same types of cases found in case law, is that feasible?
Which rule is that, Your Honor?
The attorney should undertake research and report to the prospective client how much hourly fees have totaled in the same types of cases found in case law. That's 6.
I think it's almost impossible to do.
That's what I thought you were going to say. And finally, there's advanced costs for deposition experts. Providing to the client examples of costs and that other competent counsel represent clients in similar cases, advanced litigation costs. Do you have a concern or objection to that?
I do as to what other competent counsel charge. I think an attorney does have, if the client is going to be paying costs, I think we have an obligation to tell the client, look, your cost might be $10,000, your cost would be $15,000. But as to what happens in other cases, I don't know.
Okay.
The only other point I would make, Your Honor, is similar to this idea that we should be referring these cases to certified civil trial attorneys, which is another one of these rules. There is no certification for employment law. Okay? So you may have a certified civil trial attorney who's handled 100 PI cases but never have handled a single or maybe only handled 2 or 3 employment cases. You may have an attorney like myself, I'm not certified, but I've handled hundreds of employment cases. And why I should be in a position to be referring cases to a certified civil trial attorney just because that attorney is certified, I think that's also a rule that doesn't make any sense.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Copeland.
May it please the court. Thank you for accepting our petition for certification. I can go through my argument, or I can address some of the questions that you have posed thus far, or do both. You tell me how you want to do this. I can tell you, for example, Justice Albin, you asked a question about fee shifting and how that's calculated. You have a contingency, and then you have fee shifting. Well, we've cited to case law this court's case, and the case is, bear with me one moment, and I may mispronounce it, Sapansky versus Newcomb Medical Center, 141 NJ346. And there's a plethora of federal case law on this. And they distinguish between the contingent fee and the fee shifting. The fee shifting is a part of, ultimately, the compensatory damages that are awarded to the plaintiff. So depending upon how the wording of the fee agreement is going to determine how that's divided. I can tell you in our cases, we say we take the greater of the contingency, the fee that's awarded, or the combination. And depending upon the numbers, it may be that the fee awarded is substantially greater than the contingency. Other instances, it's not.
I raise that example because the way I read the appellate division opinion, it suggested that was impermissible.
Correct, and I disagree with that. And going back to my argument, our position is this. We do not advocate that the appellate division was wrong in finding the fee agreement unenforceable. And we believe that the appellate division should have stopped at that point in time because, and I brought my new rule book up, because these rules contain most of the things that the appellate division was talking about. So, for example, under RPC 1.4, you're supposed to discuss with the client what the arrangement is. Under RPC 121.7b, you're supposed to discuss the option between hourly versus contingency.
Is that how you read 121.7b? I'm sorry to interrupt, but I'm looking at the language of the rule. And you'll tell me how it's...
That's the way I interpret it, Your Honor.
So the language specifically says, don't enter into a contingency fee arrangement without discussing the hourly fee. Is there another rule that says, don't enter into an hourly fee without also discussing contingency fee arrangements? Do you understand?
Not that I am aware of, Your Honor.
Is there a need for such a rule?
Not that I believe, and I will tell you why. Because there are many instances where you have cases where you're not dealing with a contingency, where you're dealing purely with an hourly case. And, for example, and I think that Mr. Schall cited it in his brief, where you have a high earner who has a law against discrimination case, and that earner would, I mean, certainly they could, If Mr. Shaw wants to take the case on a contingent fee basis, he could, but it makes no sense.
I understand that legitimate hypothetical. The question is, where both would make sense, is there currently a rule that says you should discuss both options? And if not, should there be?
Not that I'm aware of, and should there be? I don't think there should be, because people who cannot afford an hourly fee agreement will discuss, well, I can't afford your hourly rate. Is there some other way that we can arrange this?
Wouldn't it make good sense to have them be aware of both so they can make an considered, informed decision rather than hoping that they'll figure
the
it out?
Is it doesn't hurt. If you're asking me of all of the seven issues that were raised by the Bar Association, of all those, I don't have a problem with that.
Tell me if I'm mistaken about it. Doesn't the standard personal injury retainer agreement advise the client this could be done on a contingent fee basis or an hourly fee
basis.
The
Allstate form has that, yes.
And it's for you to choose.
If we use the Allstate form, we go through it. And in fact, we in our fee agreements, we do go through that.
But we really should be looking at the rules and not the Allstate forms. And
that is correct, Your Honor, and we don't use the Allstate forms generally. I'm just telling you that generally the Allstate form is what many personal injury lawyers use.
But the Allstate form, tell me, seems to reflect the import of that rule.
Yes.
The client should
read
be advised.
Rule. Read the rule.
Okay. And
so,
go ahead, answer his question.
I was just going to raise something with Justice Albin. You had also talked about 121.7. 121.7 has an express exclusion under 121.7C for these type of cases. So right. This issue has been addressed, and it's been decided by this court after it was submitted to the Civil Practice Committee, I think in 2000 and 2002, possibly 2004, and it's in the comments. And it expressly states these type of cases, 121.7C does not apply to.
And that's because of fee shifting.
I don't want to raise this issue.
Then don't.
What I would suggest is this, that it doesn't apply at all. I mean, there's a... In 121.7C.
Are you talking about the contingency fee rates?
Yes.
The rule.
Yeah.
They apply to personal injury cases.
Yeah.
Correct.
And not the last.
But excluding statutory-based discrimination and employment claims. So,
right.
Justice Patterson, it expressly excludes
right.
them.
Right.
It doesn't
and there's
say
very sound reasons for that.
Correct.
Is what you're saying.
Yes.
And that we should not do anything that would in any way sweep those back in to the contingency fee PI rule.
Correct. And
that would put lawyers at risk.
Correct. And it not only would it put lawyers at risk, but it would put the less fortunate people at risk. The people that don't have means, and also the people that don't make that much money. So in our brief, we cite to the restaurant server. I was told that that's the proper phraseology now. The restaurant server who makes at best $500 a week, who is a victim of sexual discrimination. And that individual loses 3 weeks of pay. In a scenario such as that, most lawyers are not going to pick up that case if there's no fee shifting. They're just not going to. There's no economic damage. I mean, there's economic damage, but what's the value of that for the lawyer? So the lawyer's not going to take that case. The lawyer's going to take something where there's something more available, which is why, yes, Your Honor, I believe you don't change 121.7's exclusion of these type of cases.
Mr. Fogart, can an attorney advance litigation costs?
Yes.
Is that appropriate?
Yes. It's under.
It has to be in the contract. In the
it, it's in the contract.
It has to be an agreement. It's not just a question of yourself. I'll give you money to survive until we get this case resolved.
So it's against the RPCs to give a client a loan. And nowadays there are third-party companies that advance costs to litigants, but that has nothing
to do
with
that's outside the attorney.
Correct.
The reason I ask you is in number seven, if you look at rule number seven, the last part, advanced litigation costs, well, it can be done. It should be more specific. You can't advance, give a client a loan in order to proceed with a lawsuit. That violates the RPCs.
That, absolutely. That does violate the RPCs.
But attorneys pay advance costs.
Yes.
All the time. Attorneys even eat the costs if they lose the case.
Yes.
Many do.
I'm hesitating there because there can be an argument that if you eat the costs and don't try to get the money back, that is that a loan to the client, and it's really not. And frankly, practically speaking, you take a case, you lose it, you have advanced costs, you're not going to sue the client to get the costs back. It's not good practice. And it's not only not good practice, from a business perspective, it's terrible. I think that's just my impression. But so, Your Honor, yes. In terms of the estimation of cost, in terms of the estimation of time, in terms of the estimation of complexity of cases, I have a problem with that. And the reason I have a problem with that, Mr. Shaw kind of alluded to it. When we get cases in, we have a feeling that it's a good case. We have a feeling that this case should be resolved quickly. And then what happens is we get an answer from, no disrespect to Justice Patterson, from defense counsel, and suddenly we're enmeshed in this complex case, which shouldn't be complex because it's straightforward. For example, if someone is called the N-word, one would think that if there's corroboration for that, that that case should be resolved relatively quickly. Doesn't always happen that way. One of the seminal cases of this court...
Maybe that's because your demand's too high.
That's the defense attorney of you coming out, I think. That's your background. But, and maybe that's so. So, you know, in the...
It's hard to do. It's just hard to predict.
It's hard to predict.
Let me ask you, in the interest of time, and
I'm sorry.
Yeah. In the interest of time, the appellate division, the components of the appellate division's rules that require research about other lawyers, knowledge about other lawyers, awareness about other lawyers, fee arrangements, and potentially referral. Do you agree with the other amici that those are ill-advised?
Yes.
and unfair to lawyers who practice in this area and would discourage lawyers from taking these cases?
I not only do I agree with them, but I think it's highly impractical. I think that what would have to happen is we would have to have a board with the fee rates that each of the lawyers charge in the state for their employment cases. And that's just not the case.
Because if you happen to know five people and you happen to know their arrangements, they could be completely out of whack with the rest of the state, and you might end up giving the client the wrong information.
Correct. And so going back to my initial argument, which I haven't even touched, we believe that the appellate division they in essence, I think, were turned off by the facts of this case, and they felt that they needed to correct, but they overcorrected here. And we believe that the appellate division's ruling should be limited to a finding that this fee agreement is unenforceable, and the dicta should not be adopted by this court.
Thank you, Mr. Felker.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Rice, we are getting to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice and Associate Justices of the Court, and may it please the Court. This Court granted certification on only two issues, the first issue being whether or not the Appellate Division went too far in terms of quote-unquote new rulemaking. And the second issue where certification was granted was whether or not the retainer agreement was or wasn't invalidated because of, quote-unquote, an alleged ambiguity. This court did not grant certification on point number three, which was literally everything that Mr. Siegd argued about a half hour ago. So the issues that he raised about potential bias by the trial court or lack of discovery or everything else that went into the ramifications underlying the trial court's decision are simply not before this court today. What is important for the purpose of my client is that in the appellate division opinion, it really gets divided into two sections of decision making. I mean, section one and two was the factual and procedural history. Section three and section four. It's only section four which deals with the suggested going forward issues, to this, which is what the amicus are talking about. But at the end of Section 3, the appellate division basically said, and I'm going to quote to a certain extent, that based on the testimony of the plaintiff, the testimony of plaintiff's child, and the documentary evidence, there was more than sufficient evidence to sustain the ruling of the trial court. And the appellate division said that that alone was ample reason to affirm the order of the trial court. So it's respectfully submitted that the trial court's ultimate decision to void this agreement should be sustained regardless of what this court chooses to do in regard to these rulemaking issues. And it's important to note that we have three different amicus submitting briefs in this case, and not one of them suggested this court that the trial court's decision should be reversed. In fact, when we look at the brief of the Association, New Jersey Association for Justice, they go on to say, quote, one attorney's unscrupulous billing practices should not provide the basis for unwarranted and unnecessary restrictions. The point being is that everybody who has looked at this record, the trial court, the appellate division, and the amicus, recognizes that the fee agreement that Mr. Sieg attempted to enforce upon my client was correctly deemed to be aborted, unenforceable, and unethical. And the trial court came to that conclusion in two things. First, before it even got to the issue of credibility, it said the undisputed facts show that there was a clear violation of RPC 1.4, the obligation to properly explain a matter to the extent possible so the client can make an informed decision. And if you're going to have an hourly component, then you got to tell the client approximately what these type of expenses are going to cost. An attorney like Mr. Sieg with over 20 years of experience should know that in a case where there's going to be experts and there's going to be depositions, and they all think if this case goes to trial, you're going to have $40,000, $50,000 plus or minus of expenses. Second, you got to tell the client that if it goes to court and it's a trial and you lose, then you're going to have a very substantially hourly bill. And after 20 years, he should have known, based on his own experience, that if you're going to try a case with depositions and experts, you're talking about six figures, whether it was 280 as he billed or even 100. But you got to give to the client some idea of what that exposure is going to be so the client can make a reasonable decision. Do I have the capacity or ability to afford that? None of those things were done. That is clearly undisputed in the record. Mr. Sieg had an obligation to say, despite the fact that he had done LAD cases, he had an obligation to say, I've never tried a bullying case. And the anti-bullying cases are relatively new. And if he had said that, then the client could make a reasonable decision. There were, however, at that point in time, and I raised this during cross-examination and the trial court picked this up, there was a history of verdicts and settlements in bullying cases that were a public record. And one could see that when the damage to the victim is substantial, like suicide, which is actually a case we have in our office now, the damages are substantial. But when the damages have been psychological, which was really the underlying this case, the damages fell in this $200,000, $300,000 range. That should have been expressed to the client before they make a commitment, theoretically, that they're going to spend $100,000 or $200,000 of legal fees. It was obvious that Mr. Sieg did not have any real understanding at all about the value because he simply turned over this $3.5 million demand that the client suggested. So all that occurs before we ever get to the issue of the credibility of Mr. Sieg. Now, Mr. Sieg, in his brief and in his petition, acknowledges that under this court's Cohn case that a retainer agreement is not like a simple contract, and ordinary contractual principles are necessarily inapplicable. They have to fall aside to ethical obligations. He understands that, and he recognizes that. He also understood the Alpert case, which says that a client can't make a rational decision whether to go forward with the retainer or not unless it's fully explained what those expenses are going to be. So when you come to the situation we have here, where Mr. Sieg tells my client, you're not going to have, don't worry about that provision of the agreement that talks about hourly. It's not going to apply to you. And Mr. Sieg then all of a sudden says, well, we should use the parole evidence rule to bar that testimony. That flies in the whole face of the Cone decision. I mean, even if we had a standard contractual interpretation, parole evidence is always allowed to avoid any type of fraud in the inducement, which effectively is what the trial court found here, that to induce my client to sign this agreement, Mr. Sieg said, don't worry about that provision of the agreement. And so under either scenario, this concept that parole evidence should have barred that testimony, I think, is simply wrong. And for all those reasons, the trial court was correct. I'm going to respond briefly, since nobody else is here to respond to some of the amicus issues, but I want to first address Mr. Sieg's claim that there was no explanation of a quote-unquote ambiguity. I think the appellate division wasn't talking about ambiguity in the context of necessarily the language of the retainer agreement, but was talking to what was the misleading concept of having these three different types of fee arrangements, the hourly, the contingency, and the LAD fee shifting claim, that it was clearly ambiguous of how those things work. Does the client understand which one would come forward? How do we pay one and not the other? That, I think, was the appellate division's concern. They were pointing out that in an LAD claim, normally the lodestar gets multiplied at the end of the case because the lawyer's taken a risk. And when a lawyer takes a risk, he's entitled to get something beyond his lodestar because of that risk. That's the same reason why in a contingency case, it's justifiable to pay the lawyer more than the hourly because he's taken the risk. But of course, in this retainer, according to Mr. Sieg, there was no risk. No risk whatsoever. That's what I thought the appellate division was gearing to. I would agree, certainly with questions that this court had raised before, that some of the 7 points that the state bar raises, certainly in the first two or three, are already a part of the law of the state of New Jersey under our RPCs. You have to inform the client properly about the risk, and you have to inform the client about the cost. And maybe this is beyond what my particular issue is, but RPC 5.1 in Section 3 says that our fees have to be reasonable in comparison to what is being charged in our community. So I don't think the appellate division was saying you've got to go to a certified civil attorney or you have to recommend this to somebody else. But I do think at a minimum, what this is saying is, this is how we handle the cases. We want these three prongs. You may find a lawyer someplace else that doesn't. That, to me, seems to be a reasonable situation. And by way of example, in an hourly case, if clients come to me, I may be in a contingency law firm, but I generally personally do hourly work. And if I tell the client, my billing rate is $650 an hour, you may find somebody else at a lower hourly rate. That's my rate. That's my rate. But at least I've told the client that that's the potential for options. I don't have to do an investigation. I don't have to know what everybody's doing. But I'm at least letting the client know that I have a very high standard in hourly rate, and I give them the option. I think the appellate division was really suggesting simply some obligation that if you're going to put these three prongs in, and the appellate division didn't void the agreement because it had the hourly component. But if you're going to put the hourly component in, at the minimum you can say there may be a possibility of other lawyers who do that without the hourly component. That, to me, would satisfy the RPC. And for all of those reasons, I see absolutely no basis for the overruling the trial court or the appellate division as to the validity of this particular retainer agreement. Any questions, Chief?
Questions, anyone?
I just have one. Has this case tentatively settled?
Yes. I have not involved in the underlying case. But my understanding is it's settled, but obviously there couldn't be a distribution until we know what Mr. Sieg's determination by this court will be. If it is determined that the trial court's decision is affirmed, then the contingent piece of the fee, pursuant to the second lawyer's contingency agreement, will be set aside, and Mr. Sieg will be compensated from that fund based on the doctrine of Ponton Merowit.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
you to all counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement, and in particular, thank you to Amici for their helpful argument.
Thank you.